Blog Talk Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, damas y caballeros, leave it in.
Welcome back to another edition of Leaving Ring Radio. I'm your host, Dave Duenas. For a minute, we almost weren't able to do the show today. I don't know what's going on with Blog Talk. They just wouldn't let us in for some reason. I was having a hard time to log in and punch in our PIN number and the whole works. But anyways, we're here, myself, Mr. Gabriel Montoya, and myself, 97 Wealth, Dave Duenas. Let's talk some boxing. Marquez, 40 years old, continues winning. And he did it against a good opponent, Michael Alvarado. Now, you know, the Mahaumai, we didn't have a chance to come on last week. You know, Gable got sick and, you know, he's up in San Francisco and he's got the Bay Area wind and the salt blowing in his face. So he's got to catch up. He's got to get immune to it. He got too used to that, those sun rays in L.A. So we apologize for not coming on last week. But anyways, you know, I picked Michael Alvarado. If you guys remember this, right when the fight was announced, I really, you know, questioned how well Marquez was going to do against a bigger guy's puncher, you know, fresher legs in front of him, somebody that can apply a lot of pressure. Well, the one thing that we kind of find out with Mike Alvarado is the big question we had about him was how well was he recovering from the beatdown that he had received from Ruslan Provokhnikov. And you know what? I think there's a little bit of both. One is, you know, anytime somebody loses big like that, especially in his hometown, psychology and physically, you need time to recuperate. I think that his team, I think that his management felt, look, he's ready. He's young. He's a lot younger than Marquez. How good can Marquez still be at an age of 40? And they stuck him out there. The best bet anytime when you see a guy get knocked out and brutally beaten down before he gets stopped is to give him some confident build-up fights. Get him back in there in the mind frame of where he was at one time, you know, which was this resilient, this pressure puncher, a guy that came forward, and even though he was taking some shots, he knew how to box, he knew how to slip, and he knew how to throw back combinations in the middle of another guy's flurries of combinations. This Mike Alvarado, we didn't see any of that. You know, we saw a guy that when he got in the pocket, he kind of would freeze up a little bit, and it was almost like he was looking for the bigger shot. Here's my thought about Marquez, because a lot of folks were like, he looked super fast, he looked great, he looked this, he looked, you know, like that. Now, I was telling this to Gabriel, and this was like, I think it was like Sunday or even Monday before you went on the next round. And that reminds me, don't forget to listen every Monday, the next round, and Tuesday, today actually, for Boxeo Tijuana on our mobile app. But I was telling Gabriel this. I said, to me, I saw some slippage with Juan Marquez. If you watch the fight, notice how when Mike Mile High decided to put some pressure on him, he froze up himself. His legs weren't as quick. He didn't react as fast as you would think he would as a counterpuncher. Here's another thing. He's really not a counterpuncher anymore. When's the last time we saw a Marquez be the leader in the dance? Really never. I mean, you imagine if you saw the Marquez that we saw when he had fought Floyd Mayweather, when they had met in the welterweight division, which was at a catchweight. But you imagine if he would have been, you know, more of a pressure guy coming forward. He really wasn't. He had his spurts, and he looked really confused when he was in with Floyd Mayweather. And it was really because he was so adamant about being a counterpuncher. With Mike Alvarado, you know, it's almost he's changed his rhythm of how to dance. And he became a guy that doesn't really look to counter in that fight. You know, he really looked like he didn't want to counter. He wanted to make openings. And that's what he did. He would pop he would throw punches at the high guard that Mike Alvarado came in. You know, he was protecting the side of his face. He would split the gloves and he would try to land these big combinations in between. Now, I got to eat crow on it. I thought Mike Alvarado could pull it off, you know, but, you know, he didn't. He wasn't able to do it. I think it was a little bit of both Marquez being good and Mike Alvarado being still in the shadow or in his nightmare of being stopped in his hometown against Ruslan. I don't care what anybody says. When you get a beatdown like that, it takes time for you to gather your bearings, for you to gather back what was kind of spewed all over across the ring on that beautiful night that Ruslan Provokov showed us against Mike Alvarado. It's almost we kind of expect fighters when they get beaten up like that to kind of put themselves back together like the T2 and from the Terminator, right? But this, it's, you know, that doesn't really happen. You know, it takes time to pick up the pieces of the glasses and put it back together. So I think with Mike Alvarado, what they really got to do, a lot of folks were saying, hey, let's see him retire. I don't think he can do it anymore. It's not in him. I'm actually just curious about what Top Rank is going to do with Mike Alvarado. Now, here's another thing, okay, and I know I'm jumping from one subject to subject, but I'm sticking to the same conversation we're talking about with Mike Alvarado and Juanma Marquez, because I saw a few people going, you know, why isn't the promoters getting involved about this testing? You know, what's up with the pimples on the chest of Juanma Marquez? Now, here on Leave It Ring, we don't like to point fingers. We like facts. That's the one thing that we love. We love facts. Because you can't argue with facts. Well, some people can. They'll sit there. They'll just be moronic, and they'll sit there and try to argue with facts and then make up shit behind so that they can make themselves feel a little smart. And that's when you just push the little block button or you just kind of wave bye to them and walk away. But here's this. The reason why, this is one of the major reasons why. Now, I'm not saying that Marquez is whatever. You guys can make your own judgment. You think you're smart enough to look at something and start scratching your head and say, this doesn't look right. Now, this is not something I know for sure. This is my opinion and my assumption, okay? Dave Duenas' assumption and opinion about why or any other promoter out there would want to do any testing. First is Golden Boy doing on Bernard Hopkins. Why would he want to do any testing? Here's the selling point for them. A guy that's supposed to be in retirement, in his 40s, in his 50s, there's a phenomenon there. And everybody wants to see a phenomenon. So why throw a monkey wrench into your money bag? Because for one, these older fighters already got a following. They got a name. You know, they're a brand already. They don't want to tarnish that brand. This is about money. At the end of the day, promoters only care about money. They don't care about anybody's walking away, you know, their livelihood for the rest of their lives. They're going to be okay in health-wise. They don't care about none of that. They care about what's lacing in their pocket, and that's all that matters, man. The mighty old dollar, you know. The thing that should be legal but still remains legal, right? So that being said, that's why you see a lot of these promoters not jumping up and down saying, hey, let's start this testing. This doesn't look right, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're not going to do it. It's just plain and simple. It's just not going to happen. And I think we're smart enough to know that. I mean, Business 101 is telling you, you don't try to, you know, you don't try to stop a money-making machine. You try to keep it. You keep feeding it the coal, so it keeps, you know, spinning its wheels and keeps going. And that's pretty much it. What it kind of boils down, you know. I mean, look. Here's the funny thing: Mike Alvarado and his camp were crying wolf when Brandon Reels was working with Memo Heredia. Why weren't they crying about when they were going to sign on to fight Juanma Marquez? Well, we'll tell you why. Because the B side never has the right to say anything. When you're the B side, guess what? You got to keep quiet because you're not going to get that fight. Every fighter that's on the B side knows that. Ask Miguel Cotto. Gabriel?
Well, and I mean, Alvarado's camp wasn't interested in testing when they were fighting Provodnikov. Provodnikov did body testing for their fight. He wanted to show that he was clean. And that's one of the first things Nonito Donaire talked about when he decided to go, just, I think, doing... Yeah, doing the 365 testing. He was doing it to show his fans that he was clean. It's really kind of about him. I mean, this week, you know, it's interesting. I don't know. Looking at this whole thing, it's really easy to get into the finger-pointing. It's hard not to get into finger-pointing. And that's ultimately not the point of this. I don't think it's a good tactic. I got apparently criticized for what I wrote last week, and you know, it's just a slippery slope. Steve actually kind of took over what I was kind of hemming and hawing with this on the next round. Because I just, at this point, I don't even know what I'm allowed to say, what people want to hear from me on this subject. I think it's even gotten diluted. There's, you know, there's constant waves of, like, new media guys. And what is a media guy anymore? You know, you've got these kind of, like, Twitter accounts, different Facebook accounts, people that claim to be journalists. They're all covering it. But are we really even doing journalism anymore? So with all, you know, just in that vein, I'm like, is it okay for me to just say, well, geez, knowing everything I know, looking at the fights, looking at Marquez, I don't know, the pimples, I'll speak actually from experience. I had to do a show, I did theater, I did that, you know, professionally before I was ever a boxing writer. I do it now. But I had to shave my chest for a role to look younger. I had to be shirtless in this part. I was playing like a 17-year-old kid. This was like 6 years ago at Sacramento Theater Company. And I'd never really done that before, and I didn't know how to do it, how to care for it. And I actually did develop a pretty bad rash the way Marquez had. I know people do get razor burn and all that. And I don't know what he's like when he's not fighting. Some fighters do shave their chest for the battle. Maybe that did happen. I don't know. It didn't happen for the other fights. I mean, I'm not giving him a pass, but
right.
What I'm saying is that, okay, we'll take that excuse away. Well, then how about the fact that he kind of looked a little flat? Maybe it's styles make fights against Bradley when he did have, even though it was like the Nevada test, and we don't even know what that kind of testing was, what exact tests were done. It doesn't seem like, you know, it didn't seem like the same bar from what I understood, that they were claiming it was WADA testing. It really wasn't. It was just done through the Salt Lake City lab. And I'm pretty sure EPO and CIR testing weren't done on every sample if they were done at all. But he still, you know, he looked flat. There was the old kind of deterrent method. We're going to do testing. And I'm not saying he's guilty of it, but this is what I observed. Pacquiao out. He has the next fight with testing. He loses, and he's competitive, but he looked a little tight, a little flat. This fight, his punches are flowing. He threw 84 punches in the fifth round. And Marquez isn't – it's not, you know, for Bernard Hopkins, he's old, and he's a whole other subject. But, you know, he doesn't – I mean, Marquez has a lot of fights. It's mileage. It's not like, well, he hasn't fought that many times, even though he's 40. No, he's actually fought a lot, and he's had some wars. And, you know, he's fought Pacquiao, like, you know, four times. He's got 486 rounds, 64 fights total. And that he's flowing like a river with his punches. He's not tired. Wasn't tired in the 12th, he didn't seem. And he hit Mike Alvarado and about sent him out of the ring. To me, you know, I haven't really talked to anybody that I talk to regularly in boxing. And even I've talked to a few people that I don't normally. And there isn't a person that kind of goes, oh, no, what are you guys talking about? He's just, you know, he's just that great. And so, I don't think I should be vilified for it, or you should be, for wondering about it. One, that's our job. I mean, we've chosen to be media. It is our job to be professionally curious and uncomfortably curious at times. We've got to ask the question that nobody else wants to ask.
I agree with you. I mean, listen.
Victor was working with a bunch of different fighters, Victor Conte. And there was a period last year, up until late last year, where all his guys were getting tested. Now, people keep using Angulo against him, but Angulo was Virgil Hunter's fighter. Angulo started working with the guys. He did some army training. He never really did the full program. He wasn't doing hypoxic training. Really, he wasn't Victor's guy. He was kind of – Hunter wanted him there, and Victor likes Angulo, likes his story, brought him in. But he wasn't an all-in dude. That's one of the reasons they split was because he wasn't all-in in terms of being allowed to do all the training and following all the protocols. So the testing with him was never really an issue because he just wasn't – he wasn't his fighter, really. He was just kind of somebody – he was like a favor. Porter, on the other hand, that's a whole different thing. And I think it's on Sean. I think it's also a bit on Victor, although Victor, I know, tried to get it done, and it didn't happen the first time. It actually wasn't their fault. They were doing – Bonnet was doing another fight that same night. in Jersey. They were doing the Rigondeaux fight. He was doing WADA. Apparently, they were having trouble getting sample collectors to do both fights happening at the same time. And so Porter, who had asked to do testing after, was passed on. When it came back around this time, it just didn't happen. One, they didn't know the fight with Malignaggi was happening until like 4 weeks out, I believe. Maybe they were thinking they were going to probably fight him, but nothing set in stone. And as far as I knew, salaries and all that didn't get worked out until even later than that. So testing just never really hit, was the last thing on a lot of people's mind. Everybody made a mad scramble. That's the long and short of it. I mean, there's probably other factors involved, but at the same time, I do believe this, and I have this conversation with Victor quite often, and I speak to him quite often, that he should do testing. His guys should be – there's not like, you know, you test like 10 dudes and then like, okay, that's equal to – you know, no. You know, I talked to with the guy that worked with him, Marlon Byrd. It's a video interview that I'm cutting right now. And he's like, dude, it's part of his history. He's never going to get rid of it. All you can do is, like, do better going forward. And so, you know, when we're talking about these issues, there's a lot of this, and it goes back to Pacquiao and Mayweather. You know, if you talk about testing or you talk about anything with Pacquiao, some dude's going to bring up what Mayweather's doing, even if it has nothing to do with the conversation and vice versa. And so when you're talking about Heredia, people inevitably are going to say, well, what about Conte? And I would agree with them. I think if you have this kind of history, if you're linked to doping at all, and you still want to work in the business, and if you want to prove that you're working clean, whoever you work with should be in a testing program. And you should do your best to get them in that program, even if it means having to pay for it or working it out some way. But the onus is on you, not us. But at the same time, there's a whole other issue on the outside of all that. The regulators need to actually regulate. But here's the big problem is that, you know, boxing is not a league. And so it's not site-specific. I mean, you can kind of put certain people anywhere. And so if you've got California and they have WADA standards, nobody's coming here to fight anymore. And if Nevada did the same thing, nobody's going there anymore. They'll find some other way. They don't need the casinos. The Kansas casinos help, but you can build local draws the way the sport used to be.
There's a
systemic group of issues. But the bottom line is that we should be wondering, because we're living, I think, in our baseball home run race era. I think we've gone through it several times, actually. It's a long wave, and we're too awake now to go soft on it or to forget about it. I think that's the ultimate point of that long rant.
You know, I was hoping that we were going to get Victor on, but I get, you know, he had a prior engagement, so he couldn't come on. But here's my thing about the Victor thing, since you're bringing it up. And I think a lot of people feel the same way, is, you know, what you just mentioned right now about Sean Porter not taking the test and whatever other fighter that he has, not taking a test. And whatever reasons have came up why they haven't been able to do it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of folks, when it comes down to it, you know, excuses are like, you know, we all have one. Nobody cares for
absolutely.
It. I think what bothers a lot of folks, and I'll be honest, it bothers me, is that I see him going after Memo Heredia about taking the test. Well, wait a minute. Your fighters are not doing that too. Before you start pointing the finger and
at
asking
the same
for somebody
time,
to
though,
do.
I will say this, Dave, and I agree with you. We've discussed this. At the same time, he has put a lot of fighters through. And currently, he's got, you know, Nolito Donaire's in his second year. They don't
but
work
see,
together
have,
anymore.
Having but, not continuously do it all the time are two different things. You can't just go, you know, you can't put your front toes in the through the door and then expect everybody to go, okay, well, he's done it once. We got to believe that he's going to stay
agree.
Clean.
They all need to keep going. But at the same time, here's the other thing. And I'll say this also about Porter. Sean didn't come up here and work for his whole training camp. They were here a week. They did a mini camp for a week. They were gone for a while. They came back at another one, I think, later. It's not like their training camp is here for like 8 weeks. So people should be clear on that. Like when they say Porter's his fighter. Sean Porter is not Victor Conte's fighter. He sponsored him for that fight. I don't know what they're going to do for the next fight. He's Ken Porter's fighter, if he's anybody's. And he's an Al Haymon fighter. He does mini camps with Victor. Victor sponsored him, and they have a nice relationship. But you have to understand, you know, it's not like he's his trainer. You know, that's Ken. Ken's in charge of everything. Each camp, as I've observed, each camp that signs up for WADA, and I've described this before, each camp is a kingdom unto itself with a very different king running it, each one of them. When you look at Floyd, You look at any one of these guys. Jesse Vargas was there today. Completely different world. Dude showed up by himself, you know, carried his own stuff, not a diva, totally friendly, worked his ass off, you know, and just kind of said yes to doing whatever kind of training they're doing, you know, like Olympic lifting and sprints in the morning. Will he eventually do VADA? You know, I don't know. We haven't even broken.
Okay, so
but
let me
but
ask you this. Well, what do you think? What is
Should
Victor Conte's role then?
$20,000 for everybody that comes to his camp for a week.
But let me ask you, what is Victor Conte's role then? What is his label working with certain fighters?
Well, that's a good question. When they come up,
you know what? I want to hold that because, you know, I think, honestly, I think you're the wrong person to be asked that because, look, I don't want it to be that you sound like a representative for Victor. I want Victor on.
I'm a reporter, though, that's been embedded and been watching the culture. So I think I'm more qualified than just about anybody to speak and answer that question.
Yeah, but I'd rather hear from
Victor.
I don't
want to sound like his representative either, but I'm not his representative. I'm a reporter who happens to work in that gym. Same way you'd say to Steve Kim, what's Freddie Roach like on a day-to-day basis? Give me what he's working with a fighter. Steve would be able to answer that question, and you wouldn't say he's a PR representative. I don't give a shit what people think in terms of me working for Victor. All that stuff, those are people that don't understand me. They don't understand Victor. So, if you're uncomfortable with it, cool. But I'm comfortable with it. I think I can explain it very well.
I know you can explain it very well. But I think the majority of folks want to hear it from him. Yeah, and that's what we've been planning. You know what I mean? We've been planning that. We've been planning to come on so we can ask him a series of questions. Me and you have talked about it. I've told you the angle that I want to go with, and you've been perfectly fine with it. And, you know, I just think we should just wait for that. We'll wait for that. And because I don't want it to end up where it's, well, Gabriel, you're defending them. Well, Gabriel, I don't want to hear that. I want to hear people say.
Dave, I really honestly, at this point in my life and with my career, I couldn't give a shit what people think about me and Victor, all that. To me, that's all superfluous. Because any of those people that have an opinion about him or me or what I've done have done absolutely nothing to help the sport. So I really don't care what they think. To me, what does the guy do? Somebody wants to work with Victor. Usually it happens through different connections. Like he knows Cameron Duncan, that works with Jesse Vargas, and he helped him with Brandon Rios. I think that's how they met. When Rios fought Murray, he was like near death, trying to make weight, and Victor was asked to help rehydrate, like if he had any ideas about it. He gave them some really good ideas using Celtic sea salt and some other stuff, but like kind of a step-by-step building towards even eating again after starving. And they brought Rios back. Apparently, Rios was, like, slurring. The guy's very smart about nutrition. His history goes back, like, over 20 years in the supplement industry. And there are some people that argue about the validity of what he's done, and there are some people that really do accept it. The people that I see, the athletes, seem to get a difference out of what he does with his supplements, particularly the ZMA, and they like his energy drink, that Expedite, and the recovery stuff. He kind of addresses things that – specifically that people do now take for granted, like recovery shakes and shit like that. And he's been a guy that's been kind of at the forefront of that, particularly with the sleep recovery. So what he does, like say with Jesse, sends him supplements, gives him nutritional advice. The biggest thing, though, is when the guy comes up, or actually I don't know when Jesse did it, but he'll help set it up for the lab. The guy goes, gets his blood analyzed. And this is the beginnings of Victor's career, where he opened a business with another guy who had bought a machine to. He talked about this on the show when he came, to break down blood and basically analyze what your body's deficient in. And then he bases a supplementation program based on that, you know, minerals, vitamins, all kinds of stuff. And that's what he does for these guys. A lot of it is just the straight supplements, like Steven Edwards, who was there with Julian Williams. All his stuff he said, like in the video that I put out, it's all the stuff that's on the website that you can buy. So there's that. I think, you know, he helps bring the guy up. A lot of it is also kind of positive coaching. If you sit around watching them talk, it's all kind of motivational. But then he brings him up for these different exercises. They work with Remy Korchemny, the sprint coach, for a day, and that guy does a bunch of stuff. He's an 81-year-old Ukrainian, legend. There's a whole track meet based, you know, named after him in the Ukraine that happens every year, and he goes back. So they work with Remy, they come over to Undisputed, and then they work on all this hypoxic boxing training that they've been developing over the years. I've been chronicling I'm on my 16th video right now about it. They're doing different like high exertion, hypoxic stuff. Now, you know, there's something else going on while I'm not around. You know, I'm not there 24/7. I go there every few weeks, hang out for a day, shoot some stuff, and I take off. I see the fighters. Have I seen an improvement in their guys? Yeah. Have I seen anything freakishly changed? Not really, no. Bruno Escalante's in better shape, I would say, but nobody's, like, turned into a knockout artist. Nothing seems crazy. Nobody's roid-raged. So I don't know. I mean, that, to me, what does he do when he's sponsoring people? He's, one, they all wear his snack stuff. They take all his products. They listen to him nutritionally. They all seem to make weight better than they ever have. And they all seem, like, happier and more positive. Seeing Sean Porter, his attitude, it wasn't like a change, but they kind of tune up. Jesse seems to already be a pretty positive guy. I mean, you and I know him well from the show. I don't know. It's kind of hard to define, but it's also kind of very smart in terms of being able to analyze where you're deficient and wherever it is physically. Like with Jesse, they're going to work on his legs and building leg power and strength, something that he wants to address because he's kind of got all the other things. So it's all – it's just kind of what the guy does. I mean, people don't realize that for 15 years he was working clean. For 4 years, Balco, they went to the, like you said, the dark side. And then he came back. His story, to me, is not one of a bad guy who turned good. It's a good guy who went bad who turned good again. That's how I see it. With Memo, I don't really know him. He's a mystery. But I just know that there's differences in their stories that are, to me, very significant.
You know, I mean, I don't know, what can we say about that? I mean, I think it just boils down what people are gonna think and what they're gonna say, and what they choose to read on and learn about. I think we point this out. We live in society where people read maybe one or two lines and then they make their judgment. We see that on YouTube. We see a lot of kids nowadays that do YouTube. I mean, I watched a few videos where the first few seconds of the conversation on YouTube starts as, I read on so-and-so's side and this site, and then they form their so-called personality, I mean, their so-called opinion, when it really it's not their opinion. It's somebody else's opinion. But anyways, let's move on, man. I want to talk some boxing here on Leaving the Ring. Chris Tanami Oriola obviously didn't take the heavyweight title. Bourbon Stiverne, he showed some scary, scary heavyweight power punching in his fight. You know, it all makes you wonder how exciting he can make that division a little bit more if the Klitschkos weren't around. Now, Vladimir Klitschko, he's a different beast. He's got a tremendous jab. If anything, I you know, it's not like I want him to disappear, but I'd like to see him just kind of just vacate and kind of allow the smaller heavyweights to go at it to make it a bit exciting. Not that Vladimir doesn't come out and do his job, man, because when you do put a contender, a number one contender or another champion, if there is one, you know, coming around, he does his job. He outboxes him, he outjabs him, and then he knocks him out in the later rounds. You know, he pretty much delivers everything that we honestly want to see from a champion, but he's just that good that he delivers everything we want to see that we just don't want to see it anymore. And that's kind of sad, you know, that we have a heavyweight champion that's actually doing the things he's supposed to do, which is fight anybody that's available, give him a boxing lesson, and then take him out. Here's the thing, though. It's not really high risk in what he does because of his height and because he's kind of mastered his jab, his reach, keeping himself tall since he's like 6'7", you know, almost close to 6'8", whatever he is. He's able to maintain that and hold on whatever Manuel Stewart has done for him and be very, very dominant. It almost makes you wonder, does Bourbon Stiverne, does he have a shot against Vladimir Klitschko? He obviously doesn't have one. If he's going to do what he did with Chris the Nightmare, I think when he knew with Chris the Nightmare would eventually, what happened to him, this is what happened with Chris, man, what I saw with Chris. The jab just disappeared, didn't have the jab anymore. He reverted back to what he did in the first fight, which was walk in the punches. He did exactly what he wasn't supposed to do. Here's another thing, is the jab is what really tired him out. He had nothing left. Also, I think that when Bourbon started talking to him, I think it really kind of spooked him. I think it just got into his mind, and he started thinking, like, you know what? I'm giving this guy some hellacious shots. Everybody talks about Chris's chin, but nobody was really talking about Bermain's chin. I mean, this guy was taking some pretty good shots. Most heavyweights would have folded and just kind of crumbled to the canvas and would have stayed there, but he did it. You know, he stayed composed. He stayed with his game plan. He told us exactly what he was going to do, which was going to wait, and he was going to, you know, well, actually, you know what? He left out that he was going to beat Chris. He really didn't beat him up. What he did is he waited, he counterpunched, and he caught him beautifully over the top of his head with his right hand, and then that was the end of the story. Chris couldn't recover for it, and he kind of just, you know, went down, and now was in the ref jumped in and kind of waved it off. Severn can't do that with Vladimir Klitschko. He's really got to have some body movement. He's going to have to really kind of have the perfect game plan with that beautiful right hand. He's got a, you know, really fast, strong right hand, and he's got to make sure he lands. Sitting on the ropes and trying to wait for Vladimir Klitschko to kind of walk into your punches is not going to happen because, you know what, he's got the, what, 80-something, 82 reach advantage. He doesn't need to try to close the distance. He doesn't need to do that at all, you know. He's not going to be in your chest, resting his forehead on your chest, and then when he pulls back, you can counter shot with your overhand right. He's not going to do that. And that's where Berman's got to use some boxing IQ and find that pocket. That pocket that a lot of fighters nowadays can't seem to find with Vladimir Klitschko. Is it because he's that good, or is it because the heavyweight division is just not that skillful? Berman Stavern obviously has got some skills, but how skillful is he against a more masterful boxer like Vladimir Klitschko, Gabriel?
Layman Brewster wasn't, you know, a master boxer. You know, it's those guys that are kind of, think of just the most classic matchup I can in the heavyweights, Frazier versus Ali. You've had a boxer versus a slugger, you know, classic. So, to me, I don't know. I like Stavern. I think you'd have to be more active. He had to fight a little bit different. He might get caught in space doing nothing and staring for a long time. You know, Klitschko's the kind of guy, he'll leave you alone if you leave him alone. And Severn, what he did was he allowed Areola to be super aggressive and just tire himself out a bit and to think that he was getting somewhere when he was getting nowhere. And then he knocked him out. You know, he set traps. He laid a foundation by getting to the body, working at the head, teeing off on that giant head, and he just kind of like went at him and when he needed to, and laid back when he needed to. It was a very smart game plan, and to me it really showed, you know, people will question Severn as a champion, and to me, I don't. I think he's already behaving like one. I was very impressed with him heading into the fight, and I was very impressed with him, you know, coming out of it. He just, the way he executed the game plan and was so disciplined and so smart, I think he'd be a problem. I think mentally he believes he's already, you know, already believes he's a problem for Vladimir. And I think that's a huge, huge part of things. So, that's how I felt about him. I don't discount him.
Let's patch in some Fight Fans here. Fight Fans, you want to call in, you certainly can. 347-215-7598 here on the Leaving the Ring Radio. And let's go with area code 714. You're on live right now on Leaving the Ring. What's on your mind? 714, you out there? No? Okay, let's go with area code 931. You're on live right now on Leaving the Ring. What's on your mind?
Hey, what's up, JIT people? It's Eduardo from Knoxville. How you doing?
Good, brother. How you doing, man?
Hey, doing good. Yeah, Gabriel asked a very good question. He's like, what do we expect from you? What we expect is for you to keep on doing what you're doing, brother. In a world full of hypocrites, those who tell the truth are vilified. So fuck everybody. Keep on doing what you're doing. There is something wrong. There is a disturbance in the quote-unquote force. There's something going on in boxing. I personally agree with a man like Marquez, who I used to be a big fan of. Man, he's been in all kinds of wars, and he's fighting like he's 23 again. It's ridiculous. I am completely turned off by this.
You know what? Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something. What I told Gabriel, you know, because we were talking about this on Monday, and I told Gabriel, because Gabriel mentioned about baseball. I said, but here's the difference between baseball reporters and boxing reporters is that baseball reporters actually care about the legacy of fighters. They actually care about the stats. Where boxing writers of today, they don't care about none of that shit. They don't care about if you break, you know, a Sugar Ray Robinson's record. They don't care about Rocky Marciano. They don't care about none of that. You know, they don't care because they want to live by the moment. They want to be able to have people come and hit their sights and, you know, give them a pat on their back. And it's ridiculous. You know, it's sad to say, but a lot of these, the majority, I would say 98% of these websites and radio shows, they're publicists. That's all they are. You know, they don't want to. I found it ironic to see that guy Woody from ESPN calling out another dude that doesn't do anything either about for the sport. You know, it was like a little shove match. You know, and you see those two kids that don't know how to fight, and they were like pushing each other. Well, you hit me first. No, you hit me first. Oh, you hit me first. That's what I saw. You know, where eventually I wanted to jump in and just sock one of them in the side of their head and say, just get it done and over with.
Yeah, it's like, look at me. It's not about you.
It's really not. It's really not.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's about this sport, and that's what it kind of boils down to. I mean, look, how many folks now – I see a guy – I'm not going to even mention his name because I can't stand the kid, you know? You know, I mean, have him just talk to you on the phone. You can smell his breath. But is this kid over here now trying to cover PEDs once in a while? What happened to – it wasn't important. You know, what happened to all these other guys that PEDs is not important until what? Mm-hmm. Until it starts making news? Until you start getting hits? Mm-hmm. That's when it's important? See, that's not what journalism about. Journalism is about finding those little niches that make you scratch your head and make you go, you know what? I'm going to walk over here to the corner to see what's going on. I don't know about you guys, but in the middle of the night, if I hear something creeping up around my house, I'm the first guy that gets up and looks out the window to see what's up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what a good journalist and a reporter is. That's what we're supposed to do. I don't get how things are and stuff, you know. I know some folks get upset about Marquez. I've had tons of emails saying that I'm a sellout, that I'm this and that. Really pissed off. And I said, listen, you're not understanding what we're doing. You know, it's nothing against the fact that Juan Marquez and Memo are from Mexico or whatever the case is, dude. My parents are from there. It's the fact that we're looking at something and all we're doing is asking a simple question. That's it. Hey, occasionally I hear some jokes.
So to be fair and balanced, here it is reported by Boxing Scene that Mike Conn's, the advisor to Pacquiao, says we'll fight Marquez at the time, but only Avada testing is involved. And this is what I wrote about Pacquiao Bradley, that they had set this bar with VADA testing. We've set this bar. This is as good as it gets. Why do anything else? And then Pacquiao backs off of it for the next fight as soon as Bob says, no, we're not going to do that. We want to use this other thing. And now he wants VADA again. Now he wants protection again. Well, which is it, dude? And you can't let him off the hook? I think it's inexcusable that Marquez hasn't used. You know, they didn't want to use – they haven't used USADA or VADA. And I just think – like, there's no real reason why you're not. Why don't you want to? Because Victor runs it. Victor doesn't run it. That can be proven. He doesn't run the company. He doesn't own it. He's the guy giving more money to them because he has more fighters that have gone through there. You know, that is true. It just makes no sense. And to me, there's many arguments that things that are bothering me about the media. They're not consistent. Okay, they were upset that he was even in this. We're talking about Victor, that he was even in the industry. They didn't like it. Then he starts doing drug testing, and then it becomes suspicious of the people that he's doing drug testing with. But then he stops, and nobody says a damn thing. So which is it? Which thread are we going to follow?
Oh, that's a good question, bro.
You know, it drives me crazy. And with Marquez, he gets to do whatever he wants. Bradley goes with VADA, and, you know, I mean, Donaire was Fighter of the Year because he did VADA. That was pretty much everybody's like, oh, it was Marquez or him. I'm going to go with him because he's doing 365. Tim Bradley hasn't been universally praised, and nobody's really had his back as VADA. I was trying to bet him over and shove some other testing organization up his ass. And quietly, he's stayed the course with VADA. We all think Tim's a good guy. We think he's clean because he wants to be tested. Why don't we support him as media? And why don't we question Bob more? And not, when I say we, not wait for me to do it, and then you guys can write about it too. It really, I'm not on the beat anymore. I guess I'm very frustrated by the whole thing. And that's why, also, out of all these guys that wonder, question about Victor Conte, I'm actually the only guy that sees him on a regular basis and watches his work up close and knows all the people that are working there. Nobody there is looking to juice. And the whole mission is actually teaching guys how to be in better shape with better nutrition, and that there's, to a person, everybody says this, that there's another way besides the dark side to do things.
Mm-hmm.
That's everybody's goal. And so when people say, well, how do you know he's clean? Well, fuck, man, you don't even know him. I know him, and I vouch for him. And if you think I'm a good person, then you'll believe me. And if you think I'm some sort of sham, failed actor, doorman, ex-Starbucks employee, and all that, mm-hmm. all of those, some of those things make me a bad person that you shouldn't listen to, then you're going to do that. But, you know, I've gone beyond caring. And I really, Dave, you know, it's kind of a weird show tonight. I think Victor's actually going to call in about 10 minutes. but I'm openly kind
cool.
of why I'm
Great.
So passionate about this is that I openly kind of question whether I even want to continue in this business because it doesn't seem like it wants to change. Baseball at least acted like it was cleaning itself up. Boxing doesn't really care. Like
mm-hmm.
they started their drug testing program and then they kind of moved along. Boxing was like, hey, we kind of got them, kind of don't need them, we're kind of good. And they're just kind of moving on. And it's very frustrating to watch.
Like the Rios thing, he got busted and then all of a sudden they stopped testing? No, that you got to push for more testing. There's a lot more people out there doing that. They need to bust the more people. It's like a dog and pony show. It's ridiculous. I'm with you. I'm very frustrated at the current situation in boxing, for sure.
Well, thank you, brother, for calling in. We're going to put you back on hold,
right,
okay? Fight fans, you want to call in, 347-215-7598. Call in right now. Every Monday, the next round. Now every Tuesday, leave the ring. And on the same day, you can get Boxeo Tijuana Radio. Make sure you download the app. It's Pat and some more Fight fans here on Leaving the Ring Radio. Let's go. Area code 708. You're on live round, Leaving the Ring. What's on your mind? 708, you out there? Okay, let's go with area code 860. You're on live right now on Leaving Ring. What's on your mind?
Yo.
What's yo, yo, Rob, what's up, brother? How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I mean, I was going to go over the Marquez thing, but, you know, I'd rather talk about the Vladimir Klitschko stuff. I don't even know why. But just because, I mean, I look at Marquez's career after that fight. You know, I thought he was going to lose because I thought Alvarado was just going to go in there and start brawling, which I thought was his best bet. Because Marquez has that shaky chin. He's always getting knocked down. Alvarado obviously didn't do that. I actually turned the fight off because I just figured Alvarado had no fight in him that night. So I just turned the fight off, like, I think in the eighth round, something like that. But, yeah, I just look at Marquez's career. I don't really see anything other than the Pacquiao win. You know what I'm saying? He's that good fighter that beat a great fighter. Like, and, you know, when I see him fight Barrera, I see him fight, you know, Casamayor, like, yeah, those fights were nice and stuff, and the Diaz fights and Casillas fights, but those guys were either really washed up or old, or they just were B fighters to begin with, you know, and I just don't really see the point. Like, is he on roids or performance enhancers? Like, I don't care. And then, you know, it's good. The fight's going to take place in China, so they're probably going to both be on some Superman stuff. So, you know, if the fight does happen, they're probably going to be on some super hellified Asian super drugs over there. But I can't really ask. I don't really care about that. It's just – but on the Klitschko thing
– It doesn't bother you at all? It doesn't bother you at all?
It bothers me, but the thing is, like, if we did – let's say we did tackle this at the Marquez and Pacquiao thing – it's really only like taking an apple off of taking one apple off the apple tree. Like, it's, there's so many things wrong with boxing, and there always has been. Like, you know, we can go back into, we can speculate back in the day where the mafia had their hands in boxing. Who knows what's going on back then? And, you know, all types of stuff. Boxing is just a type of sport where rich people want their money, and they're going to bend the rules and go around the rules to get their money no matter what they have to do, no matter who's getting hurt. And that's the real issue. It's just if somebody's getting hurt, which they are, that's the problem. But the thing is, these fighters are not – fighters, at the end of the day, fighters have more pull than promoters do now. And I said this before. If you're a fighter and let's say Pacquiao and Marquez both say it themselves, well, we're not going to fight each other unless our promoters do this and we all agree on this testing, on this strict testing, because we want to set an example. You know, but the fighters don't do that soon because in fighters, deep down inside, a lot of fighters are insecure. A lot of fighters always want an edge. And if they can't get caught, listen, you're telling me that the guy who punches somebody for a living, who beats somebody for a living, isn't going to, you know, if he knows he's not going to get caught, he's not going to take a little bit of an edge? I mean, duh, like, you know, that he's obviously going to do it. But there are, not to say that there aren't honest fighters out there, but there's more fighters that would take the edge and not get caught and not say anything about it.
To me, it's many things. I mean, I agree with you. Everybody's always looking for an edge. I'm always looking for an edge in training. You know, what can I do differently? How can I, you know, keep myself engaged in the thing? But I think the sport, I never go for the argument that things have always been bad or things are bad all over. That's a non-argument to me. It just doesn't make any sense. And it's like at that point, why police anything? You know, let's just run wild and naked in the street, you know. But to this point, I think that there's a better way, a way we can educate people. What I observed that, like, at Undisputed and watching guys, you know, like the idea of, like, I'm cutting my water. Like, that's insane. Why are you cutting your water? Like, you need water for everything in your body to work at its maximum. And yet these guys work to a peak, and then they starve themselves and dehydrate themselves, starting, like, 2 weeks out from the fight in order to make this ridiculous weight that they're not even going to fight at anyways. Okay, is there a better way to do that? And all those things, shutting down the body and the endocrine system, and all that to me are things we need to change. And I think they're connected to drugs. Guys think they need this because they're jamming the systems up for a lifetime of abuse. And then at an early age, they do start to need that because they've shut their body down. So I think it's all kind of connected. That's why I think it – and then I think ultimately what you're getting is a better athlete and better fights, ultimately. You don't get guys that have a six-pack and nothing in the tank.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It's just one of those things where it's such a big issue, you know, it's like, but, you know, if it gets handled, it gets handled, and I'd be all for it if it did. I'm not saying that. I'm not saying, like, Lil Wayne, when he talked about baseball, I want everybody hitting home runs, you know. I could care less. And that brings me to my point about Klitschko. A lot of people say he's boring and he doesn't fight anybody. A lot of the guys Klitschko has beaten, from Chris Bird to Brewster to Povetkin, in the 90s, first of all, we're talking about Mike Tyson being an all-time great heavyweight. He built his career fighting on people like Danny Green. Come on now. I mean, you know, Alex Povetkin, I'm pretty sure anybody who's seen Alex Povetkin fight would say that he could handle himself with Danny Green. But, you know, and he loses to a smaller Holyfield who admittedly was on performance-enhancing drugs for that fight, didn't get caught. But I see Klitschko fighting these guys today, beating these guys, and he's beating them really dominantly, and maybe sometimes it takes a while to get to the knockout, whatever, but he's showing skill. Like Dave said, he's showing you what you want from a fighter, not necessarily a heavyweight, because let's be honest, everybody turns to heavyweights because that's the, like, least skillful division in boxing, and you guaranteed a knockout with all the fat and flop flying everywhere. But I see these people he's beating, and there's no doubt in my mind that late 80s, mid 90s, late 90s, these guys would have been contenders in that era of boxing.
Where's
and I
day?
See a guy like Bermain Stervine.
Rob, I got to put you on hold because we got our first guest here, but I'll put you back on, okay? Give me a minute.
Yeah, no problem, man.
Thank you.
Okay, I believe
– I enjoy your calls.
Just really quick, Joel De La Hoya had a cancel with us, but we were lucky to get Victor Conte since we had brought him up a little early. Victor, are you there?
I'm here. Is this the party hotline?
This is the party hotline right here, brother. How you been? It's been a while since we've it's been a while since I've been able to talk to you. How you been?
I'm doing good, Dave. How are you?
Doing good. I'm doing good, you know. So, you know, I've been wanting to have you on, you know, so that you can answer some questions for us. It's just, you know, the scheduling has been really hectic here for us on Leaving the Ring. So I'm just glad that we've been able to catch you on the fly today. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us here on Leaving the Ring.
Glad to be here.
So my first question is going to be is, you know, a lot of folks, let me ask you this, Rick. You're pretty much aware. I mean, I see you very active on Twitter. And you see some of the attacks that some folks come at you about the drug testing and you know, about your past. Let me ask you this. Do you think that VADA testing would have gotten further if you would have been involved, if your name would have been brought up, or if you would have just been a silent, you know, a silent guy that was bringing your fighters to that testing? Because there's a lot of misunderstanding that a lot of folks seem to believe that you're the head operator for VADA testing.
I don't know where they got that idea. I think possibly an article that was written early on to the effect that it was a dream team that was going to establish an anti-doping program in for boxing and MMA, and some things were stated that were not quite accurate. And I may have made some comments at that time about you know, being excited to be one of the people that was consulted when VADA was first formed, and I knew that others like Don Catland and Dick Pound and other very influential people in the world of anti-doping were also contributing their ideas and consulting initially with Dr. Margaret Goodman. And so I think that initial article that came out that had some minor inaccuracies in it led people to believe that my role was greater than it actually is.
So that goes back to my question, is that, you know, with that already being said, with that article and people getting the misconception that you're the owner of VADA, do you think that because of your prior history, if your name had never been brought up, do you think that VADA testing would have been more successful and more, let's say, media would have been accepting the VADA testing where it's at right now? Because, you know, you've threw it out there. We've said it numerous times, is media doesn't seem to have a backbone. And you said it on Twitter, they need to grow a pair of balls and step up. But you think that they're really kind of just hesitant because of your name being involved?
I think it's an excuse that others use that are actually using performance-enhancing drugs to attack the credibility of VADA. I think the people that are making these statements are the ones that you need to look at and be suspicious of regarding the use of PEDs. So others, you know, it's a double-edged sword here, but, you know, some say it takes a thief to catch a thief. I've got experience on both sides, and I think some people realize that and think that it's a positive. Others think if he was smart enough to circumvent the anti-doping policies and procedures in place for a number of years, who's to say he's not continuing to do so? So I think it depends on what side of the argument that you're on. If you're a doper and you're a boxer or a trainer that is enabling, harboring, and promoting the use of PEDs, then you're going to attack VADA and their association, for lack of a better word, with me.
Let me ask you this question. I think a lot of folks are curious about this. What is your role? What is your label when you work with a fighter?
Dave, I think that's an excellent question, because I don't think that I can be pigeonholed into strength and conditioning, you know, classified the same as others in boxing, because that's really not what I do. I'm more of a team leader. I have had a long history of meeting with athletes that may have a specific goal. It could be to become the world's fastest human, or as in the case with Tim Montgomery back during the Balco days, where I assembled a team of coaches and trainers with a specific goal to break the world record in the 100 meters. There's been a lot of different athletes that I've worked with in many different sports, and, of course, the team that gets assembled, depending upon the goal that they have, is going to require that you have different people involved. So the same, you know, I don't have a team that works with every single athlete. I try to help develop a team and sponsor, in many cases, the team to help an athlete achieve their objectives. So as an example, with some of the boxers that I'm working with now and other coaches like Mike Basil at Undisputed and Remy Quercimney, the sprint coach, and we may have a great ART therapist and deep tissue massage person. So I guess in a sense you could describe me as a project team leader.
A project team leader. So out of that project team leader, you appoint, like you mentioned some names, so some folks could really kind of get the clear picture here, is you'll introduce your fighter to a strength conditioning coach or maybe a particular coach that attacks a certain area of expertise, right?
Yes, and I also, you know, probably would fall more into the classification of providing an individualized nutrition and supplementation program based upon comprehensive blood testing. But then also it's really important that you have the appropriate training load to recovery interval ratio. So a lot of times when you put people together and there's overlap and you get guys competing, at the end of the day, I'm like the quarterback of a football team that decides who's going to train with who on what day and at what time. So ultimately,
right,
I take everybody's input, much like a quarterback of a football team, that the running back wants the ball on every play, the wide receiver wants it, you know, and I'm the guy that's executing calling the plays and executing those plays. So I'm really, of course, I take everybody's input, but I make a lot of those final decisions. And oftentimes there are people that wish they had more playing time or more time with the athlete, because you do have overlap, and we could bring a lot of people, and not everybody's included in every program with every fighter that I work with. So it's you know, I'm a decision maker. But if you had to put the single link in it, I also have developed, you know, methods and protocols, the high exertion hypoxic training that we're doing now. Am I there on a daily basis working with the boxers and putting them on the curve machine, which is a non-motorized treadmill, or having them hit the heavy bag, or do mitts and body shield work with the use of a hypoxicator? No, but I'm the guy that developed the protocols and the methods and the logs sheets that we use for the training. Recently, I helped to design and create an altitude dome that we have at Undisputed Boxing Gym. It's an 18-foot diameter plastic dome that's 12 foot tall, and we've got four hypoxicators and a sophisticated air conditioning air filtration system there. And so I present the science and to the team, but I'm not the guy in there doing the mitts or you know, helping these guys do the specific exercises. It's just I'm trying to introduce new cutting-edge technology and make it available to some of the best fighters in the world.
So let me ask you, is it fair that these, let's say a strength conditioner comes in, do you staff them or do you subcontract them out?
In short, everybody works for me.
Okay, so they're your staff. Okay. So
I'm the boss.
Staff.
That's
the
it
boss.
In a nutshell.
Okay.
I'm the boss.
Now, I'm pretty sure you can't talk about any type of contract that you make with your staff here, but I'm curious, in the contract, do you have any stipulations of saying if their fighter, whoever fighter that they bring into the camp, has to undergo some type of testing? Are you able to implicate something like that or no?
Well, first of all, I'm the one that decides who comes in. It's a very I'm very selective. There's a lot of reasons I do things, but I'm the one that decides who's going to come in and be a part of the, for lack of a better term, the snack boxing team. So, you know, different trainers are involved for different fighters. Typically, we do have Mike Basil doing the strength and conditioning and Remy Quercimney doing the track work. But it's I'm the one that decides who I work with and who I don't work with. And so that's the bottom line. And typically my office is right down the street from Undisputed Boxing Gym, which is, all this is relatively close to where I live. And so we've got a fighters come here. It's a kind of a one-stop shop deal, and they'll come here and either do many camps or in some cases they do full camps in preparation for fights.
So let me ask you, so when a fighter, and you make the selection of a fighter that comes in, you're going to decide to work with, at any time when you decide to work with these fighters, Victor, is there ever anything in the conversation of, hey, listen, if I'm going to work with you, I want you to take either VADA testing or a suggested testing so that people know that you're clean with me. Is that something that you saw in yourself to make sure that, you know, just to kind of clear up the air with people of the assumptions of what people have of you?
Well, let me say that one of the first steps is to do comprehensive blood testing. And I'm not talking about, you know, testing for performance-enhancing drugs. I'm just talking about a standard blood chemistry and CBC, and as well as testing for individual nutritional elements. However, when you're testing liver function, kidney function, cholesterol fractions, there are markers that can tell you, you see elevated liver enzymes, reduced HDL cholesterol, other markers that I know that performance, you know, a real elevated hematocrit, as an example, from either using blood doping or EPO. I mean, if I see these markers, obviously I become highly suspicious and probe further. So during this initial workout, we're not doing the drug testing, but I would have a strong indication of whether somebody has been using drugs or not just by collecting this baseline data. Now, thereafter, depending upon, there's a lot of factors, who their promoter is, you know, et cetera, whether or not they are willing to do comprehensive blood PED testing with VADA is my preference. But that doesn't mean at some point in the future I wouldn't sponsor to do additional testing by another organization. It's a part of doing what I can to help support that individual fighter, and if that includes helping them to level the playing field with their upcoming opponent, then I've never sponsored a boxer to do testing without also offering that to their opponent. So when it got offered to one fighter, then that includes their opponent as well. Now, a lot of times, most recently, I've been encouraging some of the fighters that I work with to do random testing, and it seems like the climate in boxing is changing where even the fighters don't even know who they're fighting until 4 or 5 weeks out from a fight. So it's difficult at that time to go back when everybody's in the dark and then contact the opponent and find out, you know, will they do this, will they not, and before you know it, you're 2 or 3 weeks out from the fight, and that's really not going to be as effective as doing some sort of a random period of testing, you know, at least 8-10 weeks out. So I've been attempting to sponsor some boxers, but have had some difficulty because of the short length of time that exists once a bout is signed and the fight takes place.
So if the other opponent is not announced and the other opponent, if there's not enough time to ask them whether or not they're going to do the testing, then that's when you opt not to do the testing? Is that what you're saying?
It could go the opposite direction, and as it was the case with Edwin Rodriguez, where I tried to offer this to Andre Ward as well as Edwin, and when it didn't happen and Edwin wanted to do it, then instead of just testing both fighters for, say, 10 weeks out, 8 weeks out from the fight and sponsoring that testing for both, if one of the fighters refuses, then Edwin just stepped in and did 24/7, 365.
So let me ask you, it's been a while, right, since you guys have used VADA testing. Can you tell me what is the reason behind that? I mean, why has it kind of stopped?
Well, let me say this. I have had discussions with Sean and Ken Porter about doing this, and possibly even for him and his opponent for his upcoming fight. Problem is, we don't know who that's going to be. So have I had those discussions? Have I attempted to encourage them? Are they receptive, and have they expressed to me that they would like to do the testing? The answer is yes.
I want to go into
why do you think it hasn't picked up in the rest of the sport? I mean, you've had several fighters go through VADA. You've got one that you formerly worked with, but he re-upped for another year in Donaire, and Rodriguez doing year-round. Mm-hmm. Where's everybody else? And for you looking at it, as a guy that was kind of beginning, you know, at the bottom of this wave, you're kind of watching it crest in the last year or so. What's your take on why it hasn't moved forward? Is it the same?
I've said this recently and very clearly on Twitter. I believe that the majority of the power and control is with the promoters. So I directly blame people like Richard Schaefer and Bob Arum. They could make this happen if they prioritize the health and safety of the athlete instead of it being all about reducing financial risk, which seems to be their main concern. And I understand that, but it is what it is. And the bottom line is, Richard Schaefer has said, I'm no longer in the drug testing business. I don't think he wants anything to do with testing because of the potential risk. Bob Arum, I've had discussions with him, and after Nonito, he went basically directly to Nevada and paid a significant amount more than the VADA-type testing and said that it was going to have all the bells and whistles and would be the same and even better, and instead we found out later that it was not the same, that it was less. So his reason for wanting to pay, you know, almost double the amount for less stringent testing doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Now, I understand that ultimately the jurisdiction in terms of suspension or punishment has to be determined by the state commission. But we've seen in the past, VADA had two positive tests, and they turned those, first of all, it affected the fights. Okay, Berto was out, and they got a substitute opponent, and then the whole other fight involving Amir Khan and Lamont Peterson was canceled. So did people lose money? Yes, they did. But I think that's what it takes. I think that it gave a very bad message to the world of boxing that you get a positive test, and then the California Commission gives you a 3-month suspension. There needs to be consequences. People need to understand that you know, if you're going to reduce the use of PEDs in boxing, there's going to have to be some pain during these initial stages of people suffering financial consequences. And then once the boxing world gets the clear message that this is serious business and it doesn't make sense to take the risk because the consequences are severe, you'll see guys steering away from it. Now it's almost a system that enables, harbors, and promotes the use of PEDs, like they want it. I don't understand that.
You think it's now that it's the time for guys like us that we need to be a bit more aggressive? I mean, I mean, you've been aggressive on Twitter. I'm pretty sure Memo can vouch for that. But you have gone a little bit more. You think that's the tactic that needs to be approached? That's the way we need to approach this drug war that we're having right now in the sport of boxing.
I do. I think people need to speak out. And, you know, I understand that it's a difficult situation for the boxing scribes because the next thing you know, you're not getting the interviews, people aren't returning your calls, you're not getting a credential. You know, they'll blackball you in essence. And I really want to go back and say I think that Richard Schaefer did a lot of damage in terms of the anti-doping movement in boxing. And I thought Bob, you know, who initially supported Nonito Donaire, that Bob Arum was going to really help the movement. Instead, he decided he would go around VADA and he would give money directly to the state commission. And as it turns out, we don't even know what they were, if they were doing EPO testing or not, and they certainly weren't using carbon isotope ratio testing to detect synthetic testosterone on every sample. They used a lower standard. So, and then the next thing you know, they do it for one fight. Manny Pacquiao comes out and does VADA testing for one fight, and then the next fight he's into this Bob Arum, Nevada State Athletic Commission, lower standard testing, and you've got people, you know, Memo and Juan Manuel Marquez, in my opinion, dragging their feet, kicking and screaming, not wanting to do testing until the 11th hour. Well, you know, and I know some of these other fights, you hear Ariza talking about, Madonna did the testing for Broner, and Madonna did the testing with Floyd. But you know what? I know from the Broner side that for that fight they were tested two times, 2 weeks out from the fight and on fight night. End of story. Now, if you know right. when you sign the enrollment form that you're going to be tested, well, that's announced testing. You know, oh, okay, it's time to taper off because I'm going into the pool. That's not effective testing. And I don't believe they had much time or did very extensive testing in the Mayweather-Madonna fight. And where is that information? Who knows who did what? So the boxing world doesn't deserve to know whether there was a level field or whether there was not.
They're too worried about how many pay-per-views it did.
They've got a different set of objectives, you know, and I believe that it is the job of a boxing scribe to do fair, balanced, and accurate reporting. And that word balance means asking the tough questions. It amazes me, you know, that people, the scribes in boxing, just they're like fanboys. They just follow people around every day and in the gym and got access and promote, you know. I mean, Ellie Sussback came up to me at the Ward fight and said, well, I think that Rios is going to knock him out in such and such a round. Here's what I think. What do you think? Well, that's his boy. That's who he's hanging out with every day. You know, that's not journalism. That's fanboyism.
Right. Right. I agree.
Well, where does it go? I mean, it's at this point, there's the ground troops, people doing testing on their own, the fighters, the voluntary movement, you know, from Floyd to now. Does it move politically? Is it just forging forward and getting fighters to join the voluntary movement? Where do we go? I mean, we got, you know, Kaiser's gone, but I don't know with what we have is any better.
Well, I think it needs to be fighter-driven. And then once a fighter decides that they want to do it, then I think there needs to be sponsorship money there. But if, you know, it has to be effective testing, or I'm not interested in sponsoring it, and I don't think anybody else is interested in paying attention to athletes doing it if all they're going to do is sign an enrollment form 2 weeks out from a fight, do one blood and urine test then and another test on fight night.
Right.
I mean, it reminds me of Major League Baseball when they're only tested twice a year, one of which is at training camp. So if you show up when you know they're going to collect your sample and you test positive, you are dumber than dumb. And then they have one random test throughout the season. Well, athletes know that as soon as they get tested, it's a green light. So this is announced testing. This isn't random testing. So what really, you know, you got to crawl before you walk before you run, and I think that some testing is better than no testing. So the original model that Floyd Mayweather created of 10, 12 weeks out entering a testing pool, I think that even that, my opinion is, in some of these fights recently where they've even – you know, had a shorter period of time, 6-7 weeks, where they went into a random testing pool, even, let's say, Nevada State Athletic Commission testing. I believe that had an effect on the outcome of some of these fights. Because guys have to taper off, and then they can't use, and they you know, for a period of time. And then I believe that affects their performance. But what we're doing now is certainly not working, and so we need to take steps forward. And like I say, doing something's better than doing nothing. And am I interested in sponsoring people like Sean Porter or Jesse Vargas or, you know, others that I have in the past? Absolutely. I continue to look at those opportunities. But when promoters don't even tell the fighters who their opponent is until 4 weeks out from about, it's very difficult to put together a random testing program.
I agree. Let me take you back a little bit here, Victor. You know, because most people they're wondering what is the difference between Balco and Snack? What is the difference there?
Balco was a clinical laboratory that did blood and urine testing specifically for minerals and trace elements. So it was a service-based business. That's what we did, lab testing. Snack is a company that I've developed 13 different nutritional products over the years, and we sell sports nutrition products to athletes and anybody else out there that's interested in providing nutritional support to their exercise program. So Snack is about supplements. Balco, they coexisted in the building way back when Snack was together. I founded Balco in 1984, and Snack was founded in 1987. So all throughout the whole history of Balco, Snack existed.
Got you.
Now, I mean, go ahead, Dave.
Go ahead. Go ahead. No, go ahead, Gabriel. I'm pretty sure you're going to follow up. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just curious. I mean, while we're here and kind of in that realm of just, there's the big misnomer that Memo used to work for you, that there's some sort of connection. You and I have discussed it many times. I've even written it, but it's always better hearing it from you, you know, just explaining why there's this misnomer there.
I'll try to recap the history as quickly as I can. Memo was providing PEDs to many elite track and field athletes. And in Christmas vacation time of 1996, Trevor Graham, the coach for Marion Jones, and another guy, Randall Evans, who I believe at one point was married to Memo's sister, went to visit Memo, and he set them up with drugs. So when they came back, and a lot of athletes I know went to Laredo, Texas, met with him, got their blood tested. You know, he was developing programs. So from 96 through 2000, for those 4 years that I know of, he was a probably, they say now, more than 25 elite track athletes. He was the PED supplier for them. At a certain point in time, some of these people contacted me through mutual people that I knew, and Marion Jones and others basically discontinued working with Memo and started working with me, and this was in the mid-2000 time frame. So the person that helped Marion Jones to prepare for the Olympics and was there with her in Sydney, Australia, was me. It was not Memo. I've had no contact with Memo. He never worked for Balco. I've never talked to him. I don't know Memo. Then what happened is after the Balco raid, when they interviewed Trevor Graham, Marion Jones' coach in Raleigh, North Carolina, he told them that he didn't know Memo and that he'd never done business with Memo. And then, of course, the feds in their investigation tracked down Memo, and they talked to him. And, of course, Memo decided that he didn't want to go to prison and face criminal charges. And so he gave them a picture of him together with Trevor Graham. And then he started giving them, you know, telephone recordings and every kind of receipt and thing that you can imagine. And so he was at the top of the food chain. He was the dealer, supplier, the largest money maker in the whole conspiracy. And instead, the feds rolled him for a guy who told a lie about knowing Memo. And so he came to San Francisco, and he testified against Trevor Graham, and Trevor Graham got he got a conviction. His sentence was house arrest. Not much happened to him, but Memo ratted out. All these athletes that he worked with testified against many, many athletes who lost their Olympic gold medals and records and so on. It was quite tragic. Without going into the specifics, one of the athletes, Andrew Pettigrew, who was a coach at this time at St. Augustine College, it basically destroyed his life. You know, I've been through this sort of a scandal, and I know the effect that it has on your family. And he actually at one point went to the base of a bridge and took a bottle of pills and killed himself.
Oh, wow.
So Memo got no consequences. Memo did not go to prison. Memo did not get probation. So my opinion and belief is because he got no consequences, he was right back out there dealing drugs and making a mockery of the whole system. And in 2008 and 2009, I know in 2009 he was at the World Championships in Berlin telling people that were his previous customers that he was working with about 25 athletes. The majority of them were from Jamaica. And then he did that German documentary where he had them come to Mexico and walk all up and down to the various pharmacies buying all sorts of drugs over the counter and led him up to his hotel room where he injected EPO on camera. So am I suspicious that Memo is continuing to be a PED supplier and consultant for the boxers that he works with in currently? That's what I believe.
Let me ask you, because that was something I wanted to talk to you was about Memo. Some people have the sense they believe that you're a bit. That you're pissed that he hasn't got caught. Is that some of the drive of why you go after him and go at him on Twitter? Is because he hasn't been caught yet?
No, that has nothing to do with it. Listen, Memo tries to compete with me, but where's the competition? You know, I've been in the nutrition industry for 30 years. I've sold products that have grossed over $200 million. I currently have two world champions that I'm helping. Memo has none. I mean, he came out, helped Marquez, he knocked out Pacquiao, and all of a sudden he's supposed to be some scientist. He's not a scientist. He's never published one single scientific study in his entire life. He talks about this article recently. You know, why does it irritate me that this article comes out? Angel Memo Heredia reveals his secret to Juan Manuel Marquez's performance. He's giving them slow-digesting protein that he takes at night. And this is anti-catabolic and helps you heal. And this is the biggest crock of nonsense I've ever heard. And if anybody buys into that, then, hey, I got a bridge to sell you in the middle of the desert.
Let me ask you, whatever happened to the Memo lawsuit that he keeps forming, saying that he was going to give you over Twitter? Did that ever come about or no?
It's not just that he's threatened me. He's threatened a half a dozen people. Remember, initially he was threatening Ariza. You know, he's a lot of talk. I mean, I don't know what he understands about lawsuits involving defamation, but I've been involved in two, $25 million with Marion Jones and $12 million with Shane Mosley. Both of the cases were based on fraud. Discovery is a two-way street. Maybe they can go after emails and text messages and all sorts of evidence, but you know what? We can go after memos as well. So it to go that route, all I can tell you is I'm 2-0 with two knockouts.
There
so I would think twice before somebody comes to, you know, because I know this much. I've learned this much about defamation. The truth is a defense in and of itself.
Before I let you go, I just want to clear this up because people that first time, first time ever, even if they have, this is the first time tuning in, listening, leaving ring, and getting the chance to hear you voice on the show, just to clarify about Andre Berto. Can you clarify about that fighter? And then there's another fighter after that I want to talk to you about Andre Berto. Because some folks are going to go, well, what about Andre Berto, Victor? He got tested positive. He was dirty working with you. Can you clarify that situation?
Sure, I can. Andre Berto contacted me, and then he came here and before the Zavek fight in beginning part of 2012, and he spent 7 to 8 weeks here under my direct supervision on a daily basis, you know, with the team that we have here. And I helped him, and we went with him to Biloxi, Mississippi, and he was successful in that fight. Thereafter, he decided, because that's part of what I do, is people come to me. I'm not a hired gun. You know, I don't go other places. And by the way, there have been lots of people, and let's just talk about this for a moment. You know, a lot of people have come to me wanting to get consultation. I've had Freddie Roach reach out to me. I've had the people for Juan Manuel Marquez reach out to me and ask me if I would go to Mexico or if I would go to Los Angeles. You know, that's not what I do. I'm semi-retired, you know, and I work here. But to get back to Berto, he then moved to L.A., and he held his camp, and at that time he was training at the Goose and Gym there. And he was not under my direct supervision, and then he got injured. And then he went into rehab, you know, with some of the doctors, the top guys there that work with the Lakers and others. I forget the doctor's name, but he tore his bicep. And so there was months that he was rehabbing. And then, you know, he later, when he decided to go back into training, he set up camp back in Winter Haven, Florida. So it had been 6 months since I had worked with him. And once then they reinstated the VADA testing once he was back there, and then, of course, he comes up with this positive drug test. Now, it is what it is. It was an ultra trace level of nandrolone. I've said this publicly. I'll say it again. It could have come from a number of sources. You know, he has claimed that that on his way to Winter Haven that he went to Mexico and he ate some bad meat, and have there been cases where people have eaten meat that has been contaminated that's caused a positive test? The answer is yes. Could it be some other? I heard other stories, you know, taking deer antler spray and different things. Are there nutritional supplements out there on the market that are contaminated? Yes, there are. Is it possible also that somebody was using a batch of an anabolic steroid? You know, when you buy underground steroid products, when they make these, they you know, it's a kind of the doing it in their bathtub, and the glassware that they use is, gets cross-contamination, and they'll make a batch of testosterone, then a batch of nandrolone, then a batch of trenbolone, then a batch of primobolan, and they all look the same. They're in a cottonseed or sesame seed oil base, but you get trace contamination from through the glassware from batch to batch to batch of what you make. So are there underground, you know, steroid products that are out there, including testosterone, that could be contaminated? Yes. So did it likely occur from one of those three sources? Yes, it did. And, you know, was I in communication with him, and was he taking exclusively the products that he got from me? No, he was not. But once he lawyered up, and I helped him get one of the top lawyers, defense lawyers named Howard Jacobs, and, of course, they had promised me that they would step forward and clear my name and say, listen, we haven't had contact with him, and he hasn't been giving us products for more than 6 months, however long a period it was. But as soon as they lawyered up, they got the advice, oh, yeah, listen, you can't make any public statement. So I, in turn, came out. Hello? I hear you guys talking. But anyway, I came out and made my own statement that I'm not responsible for these fighters. You know, it's like my own kids. I've got three daughters. You know, do they listen to me? Most of the time, but not always. So Berto made decisions to do things independently of me, and somewhere along the line he took something or did something that caused a positive test, but I can assure you it had nothing to do with me.
Okay, and the last question I got for you, Victor, is this is bit of an accusation. I've seen this numerous times. A couple of people have kind of came at you about this. I'd like to hear it from you and finally get it cleared up. Was there ever any kind of involvement with yourself and Omar Henry, the boxer that, you know, passed away from a cancer or something? Could you explain what that's all about? Why there's assumptions of your involvement with him?
Okay, I'll tell you precisely. There is no real connection, but I'm going to tell you at a distance. Kareem Mayfield was training with Manny Pacquiao, and he met a guy named David Ali, a trainer. And David Ali is from the East Bay here in the Bay Area. One time, Kareem brought David to my office and showed me some videos of Kareem sparring with Manny Pacquiao. At one point, he knew that, you know, I believe it was Margarito that Omar went to Mexico or somewhere to train with Margarito, and David called me and asked me if I would send them some nutritional supplements and some T-shirts. I did. So there's a video of him wearing, you know, some of the a T-shirt and a hat, I think, and I sent some products. One day, he found out, I guess maybe through Kareem, because Kareem was training with Remy, too, at that time. And I heard at a distance that Omar showed up and kind of tagged along during one of Remy Corchimney's track sessions in the East Bay. I never talked to Omar. I never tweeted or text or emailed with Omar. I don't know Omar. I never gave him anything directly. I sent a box of some products and T-shirts and hats to somebody who was working with him at a distance named David Ali. End of story.
It's pretty cut and dry there. Well, Victor, I don't want to take any more of your time. I want to thank you again just, you know, for coming on the fly here on Leaving the Ring Radio. It's always appreciative and always a you know, great pleasure speaking to you any chance that we get a chance to talk to you here on Leaving the Ring Radio.
Always good to be with you, Dave, and you, Gabe.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate the short notice and everything. Really, thank you so much. Have a good evening.
So long.
Well, we got a chance to have Victor Conte here with us on Leaving the Ring, and I hope, you know, we were able to answer the majority or all the questions that a lot of us were, you know, kind of thinking. I know that I wanted some of these questions that for myself, you know. I mean, listen, I get some of the direct information from two of the best writers in the sport of boxing, excuse me, and you know, I sit back and I get this information. Now, I could relay the information, but sometimes, like I told another guy one time, I said, it's not organic, though, because it's really not my information, you know, and I'd rather, you know, allow Gabriel or Steve Kim or whoever, Brian Fogg's working on Al Heyman's contract. He showed me some stuff that would blow, you know, it's an eye-opener, and hopefully once he finishes up his investigation, we could share it here on Leaving the Ring. But he was able to get the advisory contract as well as your side. We both got it, Gabriel, and even Steve. And he's been kind of fine-combing it, and he's found some things there that are questionable. And so, I like to give people a chance to come on and speak what they know rather than act like I know exactly what is going on. And even though, you know, like a little earlier, you know, I had asked Gabriel, like, hold off. You know, I want to hear it from Victor. I know that Gable can answer all those questions. You know, at the end of the day, though, people want to hear it from Victor Conte. And I think a lot of folks at the time thought we were afraid to bring Victor back on. I think we proved you wrong. We're not afraid to bring anybody back on Leaving the Ring and ask them the questions you guys want us to ask. And a lot of these questions that I asked were some questions that were sent to me on Gmail, Leaving the Ring Gmail. People stating, said, hey, can you ask these questions if you ever get them back on? I'm curious. I want to know. And so here he was. We asked the questions, and I think he cleared up a lot of what were rumors, or he cleared up wasn't what a lot of people weren't really understanding. And I really stand, and I said this a long time ago. I said, listen, and he even said it himself, who's better to catch a thief than a thief? He recognizes that he did something. And instead of sitting on it and going back to the life of crime, which, you know, really, you know, he decided I'm gonna take the bad and I'll make something good out of it. And we're not pushing you to like him per se, but what we're trying to push is for you to open your eyes and say, look past Victor Conte, because it's really not about Victor Conte. It's about bettering the sport of boxing. It's about the health of the fighters that we pay good money, that we root for. The guys that, you know, we go out and ask to sign a magazine or a glove or buy our hard-earned money ticket to go see them live or pay for these pay-per-views. It's in our best interest to preserve our sport. And the only way we preserve our sport is by protecting our fighters. Now, yeah, we want to see phenomenons. I absolutely want to see phenomenons. But I want to see it in a fair playing field. I want to see guys equal to see the phenomenon. I don't think that's too much to ask. Now, for the promoters, it is because, well, the almighty dollar is right there in front of them. And, you know, he mentioned about media being afraid they're not going to get the interview, being afraid. Well, listen, folks, I mean, that's why we have strikes. You imagine if all media union where we all went on strike and just completely stopped writing about fighters and fights, and there was nobody there for the press conferences. There was nobody there to push out these fights. The publicists basically now had to do the publicists are doing it. They're opening up their own websites. So, and that's what I mean, is that they're trying to take a monopoly of what is going on. They're trying to make you be trained what to think by what they feed you. I don't know about you. I don't like that. I like the organic stuff. I like to log on there and get somebody's real investigation and real opinion. Not because the promoter or the publicist told them what to say and what they can't say. Because now you're not getting any real information. Now you're about as smart as the publicist that's giving you, he's spoon-feeding you. He or she, spoon-feeding you what you want to know.
The biggest difference between media then and now, in terms of then being the quote, pre-internet age and now, is that a boxing writer back then was a sports writer. Like Bert Sugar was an expert on horse racing as well as boxing because he covered both for the papers. Different guys that were assigned to this, they were writers first in some senses and boxing writers later, or reporters first and boxing writers, later, or they were assigned to it. Nowadays, a boxing fan wants to be on TV or wants to be in the mix, so they open their own website and they go from there. And so they're a boxing fan first, and this is how they get in. It's by, paying the piper, which is really the publicist or the promoter, by writing a piece, and, you're singing for your supper. You're singing for your credential, and you get in. And so there's this obligation. It's kind of, if you really think about it, it's just like the way judges and promoters, how they're connected. The judges are getting actually paid by the promotion, by the promoter. And in some cases, one promoter told me that they would pay the guys in cash. They'd make sure. And it's just because it was a psychological effect in that, if the promoter, because I write a certain amount of, a certain type of article or I'm on a certain site, they're going to give me a certain seat. I jumped from like row 12 to row 5 or 6 when I went from doghouse boxing. And I'd worked my way to that 12th row from the back when nobody knew who I was, up to, a little bit better seat, right, kind of in the middle of the pack. And then, boom, when I got to Max Boxing, I moved up. Your traffic moves up. Your notoriety moves up. And so there's this effect that I better write a couple pieces. I better support the card so that I can show up, eat the free meal, talk to all the people, and feel like I did my part. And that's not really your part. Your part is to report on things that are pertinent, things that matter, not what the promoter wants you to.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? I just found something new. I thought you moved up in the row because you wore a leather black jacket and everybody wanted to know, who is this dark figure? Let's bring him a little closer to the light.
Oh, that's right. Well, I don't wear that old black. Apparently, Ryan Burton was very upset about the leather jacket that I used to wear, which I don't really understand. But I don't have, I got rid of that black jacket. It's been retired. I have another black leather jacket now. Very sad.
But
there's another one. First one.
This has been kind of a weird show. We're going to be on every Tuesday night because of schedule. but hey, we always got to kind of throw you kind of a curveball here on Leaving Ring. You never know what you're going to get with us. We could sometimes just talk strictly about the sport. But then you get to catch us on a rant, and we end up giving you a two-hour rant with bringing Victor Conte on as an interview. Joel De La Hoya wasn't able to make it. He apologized. So hopefully we can get him on next week because I had a ton of questions I wanted to ask him, and I wanted to see if he would answer them for me here on Leaving Room Radio. And we've had him on numerous times. He's a good friend of the show. And we got about maybe another 6 minutes here on Leaving the Ring. I guess we should make our quick prediction of what's happening this weekend, Gable. I want to pull that up and throw it out there. What fights do we have rolling on Friday and Saturday? Oh, we got the Boxino. The Boxino, I'm really excited, happening this Friday. Finally.
I have trouble saying the phrase Boxino because I just get the feeling that Dan Raphael made it up. But that's just me. I don't know. I don't really understand why they have to call it Boxino. But
I don't know either.
Friday night. Turning Stow Casino in Verona, New York. ESPN2's Friday Night Fights. Boxino Tournament Final. Brandon Adams versus Willie Monroe Jr., middleweights in action, 10 rounds. Both styles are very similar. They're kind of, athletic boxer punchers. I kind of lean more towards Monroe. I'm not turned on really by either person in this matchup. Peter Petkoff versus Fernando Carcamo, lightweights, 10 rounds in action. That, my friend, that's going to be a good fight. Petrov's a nice brawler. He gets kind of compact, low to the ground. He moves his head side to side, gets in, digs to the body. Carcamo is a bit lankier, more of a boxer puncher, kind of a more classic boxer, but he's got power. God, I was watching that Vicente Escobedo knockout part of the tape, and I mentioned it on TNR, but it's so loud I had to mention it again. It might be the loudest knockout I've heard ever. I mean, it's just like he hits it out of the park. I'm leaning towards Carcamo in that one.
We didn't even have a chance to talk about the Cotto and Martinez face-off, man. I really wanted to talk about that, but I guess we'll catch up with it next week. Hey, you know that this Boxino is not the first time. I believe they did it back in the 60s or 70s, this tournament. So,
well, there you go.
I don't know why.
Unremitted.
Yeah. You know, but I am excited about it.
In the 60s, 70s, whatever time period you want to put it in, Boxino is a silly name. Saturday, May 24th, Bell Center, Montreal, Canada, Showtime. Adonis Stevenson makes his Showtime debut versus Andres Fanfara, light heavyweight, 12 rounds for Stevenson's WBC title. Chief support is David Lemieux versus Fernando Guerrero, middleweights in action. I think it's going to be a fun fight for as long as it lasts. Guerrero's got nice technique. He can move. He's as light on his feet as anybody I've ever seen. He does not take hard punches very well. Lemieux, limited short arms. Not the fastest guy, not a defensive wizard, can box, but really what he can do is put your lights out with either hand. So that's going to be a fun one. What do you got in the main event? I mean, everybody is acting like it's a foregone conclusion. Are you going to go upset special and lean a little towards Fanfara, or are you going to go with the chalk and say that Stevenson gets him out of there as everybody's expecting?
You know, as everybody knows, I always like to pick the underdog, but this one is just way, way, way under. I just can't pick him. I'm going to go with Superman here on this one. I think he stops him. I don't think he goes very long. I think he probably goes about maybe 5 or 6 rounds. With Lemieux and Guerrero, you know, the thing about Lemieux is that he's got punching power. He's got short arms, doesn't have any head movement. He gets clipped a lot, but he also gets hurt. Guerrero's not the only one that gets hurt. So I'm interested in how well David Lemieux takes the punch. I know he's been having a good winning streak here of himself, but he is able to get hurt. And when he gets hurt, he still hasn't learned how to get himself out of trouble. So it's an interesting fight. I think that fight there on the underline of the main event is the by far more interesting fight. I don't think it's going to steal anybody's show, though, for Saturday night, man. It's just going to be a fill-in for the month, and that's it. And then we move on.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of funky. It was supposed to be just a tune-up that led to the fight everybody wanted to see. But instead, it's just Stevenson versus Fanfara.
You know what's going to be funny is that everybody in Quebec is going to be like, ooh, did you see that knockout? Oh, man, wouldn't it have been great to see Kovalev and Stevenson just go at it?
That's going to be next. No, wait. Like, there's nothing exciting about it. It's just kind of
I hope somebody in Canada, after you have a chance, if you see Adonis Stevenson after the fight, if it sways his way and he gets the knockout or whatever the case is, I believe he is. But somebody pat him on the back, congratulate him, and say, "Oh man, great knockout, great whatever." You really wanted to see the Kovalev. What happened? Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's going to give you the same old spew that he's given everybody else. But anyways. I'm your boy, 97 Rough, Dave Duenas.
Nobody's going to mention. I'll make a prediction. Nobody mentions Kovalev afterwards.
That's a good
one.
In
the ring.
I like that prediction.
No, nobody's going to mention it. Not on the air, anyways. It doesn't exist. It's a whole other universe.
Well, it's hard to ask questions when your mouth is full of food because of the free food that's in the back. That's a perfect excuse for the media there. Anyways, this is your boy, Dave Duenas, 97 Rough, with your boy, the Dark Cloud. We saw him come back again. Finally. Gabriel Montoya, the Dark Cloud, showed up today here on Leaving the Ring Radio. Again, every Monday night, you got the next round with Steve Kim, the K-9, and Gabriel Montoya, the Golden Gate San Francisco guy. He's a different person on the next round. Remember, only on Leaving the Ring on Tuesday nights here at 6 p.m. from 8 p.m., you're going to get the Dark Cloud and 97 Rough. But on the same day, on the app, you're going to catch Boxeo Tijuana Radio. You haven't tuned in to the All-Spanish Boxing Radio Show. You need to run to it. Download the app. Get on there and rate us, man. Hey, show your support, too, as well. Anyways, you guys all have a good night. Enjoy your weekend. Remember, don't drink and drive because you will spill your beer.
Dave, as always, strange show, always a fun show. I mean, you know, we lost Joel De La Hoya. We gained Victor Conte. And I think we asked them all the questions that people wonder about on Twitter but never really actually ask him. I commend you. Excellent interview, Dave. You took the reins and did a hell of a job. So until next week, peace.
Peace.